This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The PGA Championship is weeks away here in Charlotte, but disc golf is already here and growing in popularity. We learn more about that later in the hour. First, I want to update you on what's happening in Alexandria. Louisiana Congressman Steve Scalise, the House Majority Whip, is among five people reportedly shot in Alexandria at a baseball field during practice for a congressional baseball game. Alexandria police say a suspect is in custody. The gunman was reportedly armed with a rifle. And you can stay with WFAE and NPR. We'll have more details for you as those details become available. Less than a week after former FBI Director James Comey's must-see TV appearance before the Senate Intelligence Committee, yesterday Attorney General Jeff Sessions made an appearance with his version of events surrounding Comey's firing and the Russian investigation. And here to talk about the significance of that and of what Mr. Sessions said is Dr. Peter Feaver, professor of political science and public policy at Duke University and the director of the Triangle Institute for Strategic Studies. Dr. Feaver, welcome back.
Well, it's good to be back here.
So what were you watching for in Attorney General Jeff Sessions' testimony yesterday in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee?
Well, broadly, how he answered two large baskets of questions. This is an enormously complicated issue, but it you can throw all of the issues into one of two baskets. Basket one is, what did the Russians do to attack our democratic institutions, to undermine our democratic process, to hobble the United States domestically and therefore make it weaker in the international system? And there's a whole series of questions related to that. And then there's the second basket of issues. What, if anything, did the Trump campaign do in collusion with that? And then since winning the election, what, if anything, did the Trump administration do to block investigation of it? And that's that second basket of issues. And the problem is that the media and, frankly, the administration has been preoccupied with that second basket of issues and has missed focusing attention on the first basket of issues.
And what did you take away from yesterday's testimony? Did Attorney General Sessions' testimony shed any light on either of those baskets of issues?
Not really. He made it clear that he rejected the allegations or insinuations that have been circulating in the last week since Comey's testimony, the insinuations that Attorney General Sessions was himself not fully candid or may have not fully implemented his recusal. And that's a second basket issue kind of set of questions. And Attorney General Sessions denied the allegations, but then was very careful about providing corroborating evidence, because he said in order to protect the president's executive privileges, Sessions would not talk about private conversations he had with the president or inside the administration. So it was basically a he said, he said kind of denunciation of the worst of what Comey implied last week. But that's all second basket issues. When asked about the first basket issues, he said that he took the allegations of what the Russians had did very seriously, and that it was a very serious problem, required lots and lots of action, and more action was required, but did not give much detail on the administration's thinking on the issue. And
almost sounded as though he's never had a meeting about that.
Well, if there are meetings and strategies being developed, they are not leaking into the public record, so we don't know about them.
I want to talk to you about your personal opinion about what you're hearing out of Washington and what you're hearing out of the administration about the president's handling of this or about anything else surrounding this, because you were a former security advisor to President George W. Bush. So talk about this. Is it normal for an attorney general to come before Congress, not invoke the Fifth Amendment, not invoke executive privilege, which is something only the president can do, but in situations where the president has not invoked it, to not answer the questions of congressional representation, of representatives?
Well, it's not unusual for administrations to make sweeping claims of executive privilege. So that part,
but they haven't.
Well, they've been they haven't explicitly, but they have been very careful to preserve their the possibility of doing so, and that's how I interpret the caginess of his answers. And I also, because the charges in that second basket are so inflammatory, it's understandable that the administration focuses on them and is, you know, angry in denouncing them. And it's even quite possible that that when all is said and done, they'll just have been lots and lots of smoke in that second basket, but no fire. And here's my point. Let's concede that the administration, for the sake of argument, let's concede that President Trump is right, that there's no collusion in the campaign, and that he did not obstruct justice in firing Comey or in any of the handling of the issue since. But that still leaves the first basket. And so there's still a very important public policy question. What is the administration doing, if anything, about that larger issue of Russian attacks on the United States? And I think if we spent less time focusing on the most inflammatory charges of collusion, we might have some pretty tough questions for the administration that they would have trouble answering. Because, as I said, if they are working on that part of the issue, it hasn't leaked into the public
yet. So as a former security advisor to President Bush, George W. Bush, how would you characterize the possibility that the Russians tried to hack our election system and any possible connection by members of the Trump campaign to that attempt?
Well, see, you just mixed the two baskets.
Basket by basket.
Yeah, what I would say is the first basket of issue represents one of the most serious threats facing the United States today, on the level of the North Korean nuclear threat, on the level of the ISIS terrorist threat, on the level of the Iranian nuclear ambitions and regional mischief threat. On that same level is Russian action directed to undermining American public's confidence in its democratic institutions. That's a big threat, and any president, any administration should take it very seriously. And the evidence that the Russians have been doing that is pretty overwhelming. In fact, it's a consensus position of all of the intelligence community that that happened.
Right.
So that's a big job that should preoccupy the administration.
Can you think of anything comparable to this attempt by Russia to hack our election system and possibly other parts of our government or infrastructure? Can you think of anything comparable to that in recent history?
Not in recent history. And, of course, in order to do that, the Russians took tactics that they used during the Cold War. And there was lots of efforts during the Cold War to manipulate and undermine U.S. Domestic politics in various ways. But they were limited in their effectiveness because the Internet didn't exist and the media environment was different. The Russians have shown that they have been able to master some of the new technologies and thus leverage those technologies to have much greater impact than they were able to have during the Cold War.
Would they have necessarily needed the help of Americans to do what they have done?
No. No. They did not. This story, this problem in the first basket, does not hinge on collusion with the Trump campaign. Namely, doesn't hinge on any answer in the second basket. It's entirely possible that President Trump is correct and that he is innocent of those charges in the second basket, but that still leaves the first basket of problems.
Right.
And we as a country have to be dealing with that first basket, and we've spent too much time looking at the second basket.
So,
my advice to the administration would be let Mueller look at the second basket and instead focus on addressing the first basket.
So we only have about a minute or two left here, but as a national security expert whose responsibilities at the White House during the George W. Bush administration included national security strategy, does evidence of Russian hacking of state-by-state elections systems, is it indicative of a deeper problem? Could they be poking around elsewhere?
Yes, it's an indicative that the U.S. infrastructure, whether it's the political infrastructure of the election system or the energy infrastructure, our electrical grid, or even, you know, our water supply, all of these things, if they're connected to the internet in any way, then they're vulnerable to these kinds of attacks.
And also characterized what we've been hearing in these congressional hearings, these leaks of classified and unclassified information to the media about what's going on behind the scenes in the administration. How detrimental is that to national security?
That's a separate issue, and that is harmful. President Trump is right. It's hard to govern when the administration is leaking and when classified material is leaking into the public quite so readily. And so he's right to be concerned about those leaks. President Obama, President Bush before him, they were all concerned about these leaks, and they're not helpful for national security.
Dr. Peter Feaver is professor of political science and public policy and a former White House security officer at the during the George W. Bush administration. He's at Duke University, and he's the director of Triangle Institute for Strategic Studies as well. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're still following the story of the shooting in Alexandria, Virginia today, of Louisiana Congressman Steve Scalise and five people at a baseball field in Alexandria. When more details about that become available, we will bring them to you. Later this summer, some of the best in professional golf tee up at Charlotte's Quail Hollow Country Club for the PGA Championship. But Charlotte is already a destination for disc golf, home to more than a dozen disc golf courses and hundreds of players. Well, we were curious about what is behind the growing popularity of a sport about which many people might be unfamiliar. And here to enlighten us are Andy Goh and Jeremy Kohling. Andy is a disc golf player and co-host of the Final Round Radio, of Final Round Radio. That's a disc golf podcast. I'm going to have trouble with this morning.
That works.
Okay, thanks for joining us. Jeremy Kohling is a professional disc golf player and the 2016 U.S. Disc Golf Championship winner, who will be competing next week at this time at the World Championship Games in Augusta, Georgia. Welcome to the both of you. Good to see you.
Thanks for having us.
Well, for those of people who are not familiar, and I'm one of them, with disc golf, I mean, I was out there. It's out there in the periphery of my consciousness. Describe it. What exactly is it, Andy?
Well, Mike, disc golf is exactly like regular golf or ball golf, as we like to call it. It's the same game, the same sort of goals. You're trying to shoot under par or as close to that as possible. But instead of using balls and clubs, you're using discs and you're throwing them into baskets.
Because it looks like a combination of frisbee and basketball, if you want to come right down to it.
It is.
Accurate?
You could say that, but it really is just a different version of the game of golf.
Uh-huh.
All the mental challenges are there, all the same sort of thought processes and trying to shave strokes down are there, and definitely that mental challenge that brings so many players back to the game of golf is also present in disc golf, which is what makes it so unique and so much fun to play.
Is it more interesting to play than it is to watch, or vice versa?
It's very interesting to do both. First of all, anybody can play disc golf. Truly, anybody who's listening to this, no matter how young they are, how old they are, male, female, doesn't matter. As long as you can get out to a course and throw a disc, it doesn't matter how far, then you can go play and have fun. So it's a lot of fun to play, but it's also a lot of fun to watch, too. Especially when you get up to the professional level, guys like Jeremy Kohling here, who are some of the best players in the world, when you get to watch them do the things that they can do with these discs, it's almost superhuman. And we're really lucky here in Charlotte because we do get a lot of top players playing around here.
Well, we're kind of the epicenter. We're going to talk about that in a second. Jeremy, you're a native Charlottean, is that right?
Yeah, I was born in Charlotte, and I grew up in Chapel Hill and came back to Charlotte for high school, went to Myers Park High School.
So when did this involvement with disc golf, because you're the national champion, when did it begin for you?
It actually began after my sophomore year in college. I was going to Appalachian State, and I was playing club ultimate frisbee up there, and just was infatuated with the flight of a frisbee or a disc, and was playing catch constantly. I always had more frisbees in my bag than books. I've always been interested in flight, and I came home from my sophomore year of college, and a couple of my high school buddies were going out to Renaissance Park on Tryon and Tyvola, and we just played my very first round of disc golf, and
Well, from a Frisbee, I think everybody has thrown a Frisbee in their life.
Sure.
So from a Frisbee person's point of view, what was the difference that first game that you played? What was the difference?
The difference for me was that I had always grown up aspiring to be a professional athlete, but in team sports. First it was soccer, then it was basketball. And disc golf gave me a unique opportunity to play a sport where I was the one who was responsible for winning, losing, playing well, not playing well, etc. And it was a learning experience for me. I learned so much in my life in the last 11 years through playing this game. And I'm still learning. And it's for me, it's just a way of really understanding oneself and how to breathe and control situations that are sometimes out of your hand. I mean, there's so many things that I've learned, like I said, just through life, through the sport.
Have you played ball golf, as you've called it?
You can call it ball golf. You can call it traditional golf. I just call it golf. I mean, that's what it's called. Okay. They're golf. We're disc golf. And
so have you played golf?
I actually have. I've played a couple rounds. I mean, I am a novice.
Is there a difference in the mindset when you play golf versus disc golf?
You know what? I'm sure there is some. I haven't really jumped into golf enough to really understand exactly what's going through your mind. But yeah, it is all muscle memory. It's recreating strokes or throws that you've done a million times before. Mm-hmm. And that's between, you know, the 6 inches between your ears.
So this sport is exploding nationally, evidently. And I understand we're one of the best, if not the best city to be in to play this sport. And we'll talk about why. But why first? What is leading the explosion of popularity and interest in this sport nationwide? What's happening there, Andy?
Well, I think it's people looking for something new, something different, and something very accessible to be able to entertain themselves with. A lot of traditional golf courses are slowing down. They're not being built as quickly. They're not as profitable as they used to be. People don't have the expendable dollars that they once did to be able to spend on golf. So enter disc golf, which is generally free to play. Most of the courses are built in public parks, so you don't have to pay a greens fee to play them. You just have to have a couple of discs, which you can buy for, you know, anywhere from $6 to $20 brand new. Just go out to the park and have some fun with it. So it's really easy for anybody to play. Again, families can play, friends can play, and even organized tournaments can play. So there's a lot of different ways to get into it.
I know that $6 to $20 is a lot cheaper than buying a set of clubs.
It sure is.
And the associated balls that go along with it, and the club bag, and the greens fees and things like that. But tell me what makes a piece of plastic that you can throw in the air worth $20.
I'll take this one. you know what? You can spend between, like Andy was saying, $6 and $20 on a brand new disc, but you can also spend upwards of $2,000. There's a collector's market out
there.
Yeah, it's pretty intense. If you get on any sort of online marketplace and you look up disc golf and you look at the highest priced items, they're up there. I guess the difference is the quality of the plastic. So you have baseline plastic, which after hitting trees or rocks or really just a little bit of wear and tear, the disc begins to chip, and it doesn't quite have the same stability over time.
Is there an aerodynamic quality to these discs?
Oh, absolutely.
And do you use different discs for different moments on the course?
Oh, absolutely. So there are a huge variety of discs in terms of the molds. You have drivers, mid-ranges, and putters, just like you would in golf. Our discs aren't quite the same size as your normal catch frisbee or beach frisbee that most people are accustomed to. They're about 60% of the size of a catch disc, but they weigh about the same. So they're much more dense. They're a lot more aerodynamic, and they're actually sharp. It's not something you want to play catch with. And these discs are meant to fly different ways, go different speeds for several different types of shots.
So instead of a golfer would change his club,
right,
depending upon the lie of the course and where the ball is and what he wants to achieve, whether he's going to drive the ball or he's going to putt the ball, etc. Or he's in a sand trap and he needs to hook it out.
Sure.
Is the same thing applicable in disc golf? Do you change the disc depending upon where it lands on the course and where you want to go to next? Is that how it works?
Absolutely. So, you know, just because you have a driver doesn't mean that you have to throw that off the tee. You can throw putters that go straight, mid-ranges, which curve a little bit, and drivers, which curve a lot. they're shots that are meant to roll. You have overhand shots, which do a kind of a barrel roll in the air, and they all have different there's different reasons for throwing different shots. So yeah, if you're in the trees or if you're in a bad spot, you need a disc to go left or right or straight. There's something for everything. And so the creativity is one of the really unique parts about the game.
Charlotte, Andy, has been described as a mecca for this sport. And I'm curious as to why, number one. And number two, how did it happen?
Well, let me start with this. Charlotte is one of the best cities in the world for disc golf because it has the highest density of championship-level 18-hole courses within an hour's drive of uptown than any other city anywhere.
Wow.
There might be cities with better courses, but they're fewer and farther in between. There might be cities with more courses, but they're not as good. So Charlotte has that really good sweet spot between having quality top-level courses that'll challenge guys like Jeremy Colling here, and also having enough of them to where you can have your choice to play at any time.
How did that happen?
It's happened over several years. Two of the biggest reasons why are a great relationship between the Charlotte Disc Golf Club and the Mecklenburg County Parks and Rec Department. In fact, on our podcast, if I can get a little plug, we will actually talk to Peter Cook of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg County Parks and Rec Department on our next Final Round Radio podcast about that very relationship that allowed the partnership to grow and for Charlotte-Mecklenburg to be able to devote as much space as they have to public parks.
So there's that disc golf. There's that relationship, and then one fellow's name comes up a lot when you talk about this and you read about it. Stan McDaniel.
Oh, jeez.
He designed the. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It's both. Okay. It's mostly. Well,
it's very good.
It's great.
He designed. That sounds disingenuous.
No, it is. It really is.
He designed the Renaissance golf course, which has been described by DGCourseReview.com as a monster of a course. Yeah. What makes it a monster?
It's a monster because it is, especially in the summertime, it's overgrown. It's hard for the park to get out there and always clean it up in terms of the overgrowth. And if you're off the fairway, you are in some thick brush. And it's difficult because it's a par 70. A lot of people, when they think of disc golf, if you ever have heard of it before, you might think all par threes and just a walk in the park. Renaissance Gold is nothing like that.
Who decides on the par rating of a particular hole?
Oh man, you're getting into a big discussion here, Mike. par is really based on the loose definition of par is how many strokes it takes to get from the teeing area to the putting area plus one stroke for par. So if it's a par three, then you should be able to access a putting area within one throw. Be putting for your birdie and allow for one miss and then one extra throw for par. So if it takes two quality throws to get to the pin, then that will be a par four. And if it takes three, it's a par five. So
who makes that decision? How is that arrived?
The players, based on the skill, based on how you can access the shot. So, I mean, just like in golf, if they can reach the green in one, relatively, it's going to be a par three most of the time. Now, there's going to be some holes that the longest hitting golfers can reach the green in one, and they have a chance for eagle. And it's the same way for disc golf.
Are there holes in one? Oh, there's in this sport.
Way more hole in ones.
Really?
Yeah, you're asking a funny person here.
You've done this many times.
Well, more so than me doing it, I've actually been on ESPN in the background for several aces, and it's kind of become a online phenomenon that anytime there's an ace, Big Germ, which is my nickname, I'm always around. And my other nickname is the bridesmaid because I'm never the one getting the hole-in-one. And so, yeah. It's funny that you bring that up because that's kind of a pretty interesting phenomenon. Disc golf has actually been on ESPN several times in the last couple of years for hole-in-ones.
Do they whisper like they do on CBS for the Masters?
The disc golf culture is a little bit more rowdy. The fans, one of the things that's so amazing about the sport is how accessible it is. If you come out to a competition, you'd be amazed at how approachable the professionals are and how close you can get to the action and really communicate with the players themselves. And I think that that's one of the things that makes disc golf so interesting is that, the professionals aren't out of reach. They're not like these characters or these figures that are above life. Like, yeah, you can really engage with these people and really get to know them well on a personal level. So
there are 17, I'm told, disc golf courses that are sanctioned here in Charlotte by the Charlotte Disc Golf Club. What's required to achieve that recognition?
Jerm, can you answer that?
I just think that if it's in the Charlotte area, you know, the club will take responsibility for upkeep, and I really don't know what else it takes than really just being in the Charlotte area.
Regular golf courses, they like to tout, particularly big courses, famous courses, they like to tout who it was that designed them. And a lot of thought goes into designing the golf course to make it challenging and to make it difficult to play. And it's the same true of these courses.
Absolutely. And that brings us back to the gentleman we were talking about earlier, Stan McDaniel, who is probably the most prolific course designer here in Charlotte. He has had a hand in designing just about every course here in the city. And going back to your point earlier, Mike, of why Charlotte got to be such a good city for disc golf is through the efforts, through the volunteer hours, the endless time spent, you know, cutting down fairways and cleaning up different parts of the woods. That's really what's been able to propel Charlotte to be where it's at, is through the efforts of guys like Stan and others who have built this scene from scratch.
And to go is a disc golf player. He's also co-host of Final Round Radio Podcast. And Jeremy Kohling is a professional disc golf player, the winner of the U.S. Championship last year. We will continue our conversation in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about disc golf in Charlotte. We are the mecca of disc golf in the country. For some reason, we have more sanctioned golf courses for that sport than just about anywhere. And we have with us today the U.S. disc golf champion from last year, Jeremy Kohling. He's a professional player. He's also here. He's with us, and as is Andy Goh, who is also a disc golf player and host of Final Round Radio Podcast. Both of them are involved in different podcasts for this sport. That is indicative, it seems to me, of interest. If there's more than one podcast about a topic, it has to be interesting to a significant amount of people. How many people does your podcast reach? Do you know, Andy?
Oh gosh, we get probably about 20,000 people in a month listening to the
show.
On average, yeah. About 8 or 9% of that is international. That's the other thing, too, is that disc golf is huge internationally. There's a big following in, you know, Sweden, Finland, Denmark, Japan, all, you know, a lot of other places all around the world. And it's great to see that popularity continue to grow.
And you, Jeremy, were involved, or you helped start a podcast called Two Pros and an Average Joe.
Yep.
How does what you do differ from what Andy does?
Well, I think the Two Pros and Average Joe podcast kind of covers a little bit more of what tour life is like.
Mm-hmm.
I live on the road. I'm very rarely back home in Charlotte. And on our podcast, myself, Paul Ulibarri from Mesa, Arizona, and Brady Hanna from Iowa, we get together occasionally and we just talk about what's going on the tour and give people a little bit more of an insight of like what our day-to-day like activities are. And, you know, that podcast is just kind of a fun outlet for us to just kind of get some content out there and let people kind of connect with the professional side.
If you live on the road, that tells me there's money to be made playing this sport if you're at a certain level, which obviously
sure.
You are. You're at the top of your game and the top of the game. You can make a living at this?
Oh, absolutely. That's probably the number one question I get when people ask, what do you do for a living? And I tell them I play disc golf. And they said, you can do that for a living? And, you know, I have to explain this several times a week, actually. And, yeah, you absolutely can. I mean, just like any sport where there's an entry fee, everyone puts their money in, and then there's a pot. And the tournament directors will raise money for events. And so part of my earnings are through tournament earnings, and then the other parts are through sponsorships and disc sales that, you know, have my brand on it.
So it's like any other sport. If you're really good at it, the people who make the frisbees or the discs,
yes,
want to have you throwing their brand,
of course,
wearing their emblem on your clothes when you're playing. It's just like golf.
Sure.
Where do you go you're always on tour. You're never here. So where are you? Where do you
where
go
do
to
I
play
not
this
go?
Game?
That's the question. I mean, this game has taken me to Australia, New Zealand, Finland, Sweden, Denmark, Estonia, and all around the country. I mean, I just came
it
back.
It sounds more popular than golf or more ubiquitous than golf.
It's incredible. I mean, to be able to do what you love and travel around the country and the globe doing it is it's a dream come true. So, I mean, to be able to just travel, it's amazing that people can do what we do.
Do you have a favorite course?
Yeah, I do.
Where?
It's in Stockholm, Sweden, actually. It's called Järva. And my favorite course in the United States is probably Maple Hill in Massachusetts.
But now, wait a minute. We're the Mecca.
We are the Mecca. We're like Andy was explaining earlier, like there's a ratio kind of like how you kind of interpret Mecca is up to you. Some people, there's plenty of places in the United States that have a lot of courses and a lot of good courses. I think that we have the most good courses, and we don't necessarily have my favorite course. Although Hornets Nest Park and Renaissance Park are two of my top favorite courses. We just have such a plethora of courses and such a different – we have options from very early beginner skill set to championship level, like courses that still give me a tough time.
What makes a champion in this game? What sets you apart from the guy who goes out and plays as much as he can?
If I put this on the air, then people are going to know the secret, and I don't think that I want that.
The secret sauce.
No, I think that it really just comes down to confidence and acceptance of things that take a lot of time to really learn. I mean, the mental game is the hardest part of the sport, just like golf, just like a lot of sports. It's the mental capacity of the player, how they can perform when the time comes, end of event, where there's people tracking you down. It's hard to match your heart rate to what it's like when you practice and be able to do the things that you do when there's no pressure on the line. And I think that what sets the champions apart from just the average player is just confidence in oneself. I mean, just like many sports, it's just all about having that confidence that you are going to do what you need to do at the right time.
I could be wrong about this, but you can set me straight, Andy. It seems to me that this is a kind of sport that is attractive in part because almost anybody can play it, young or old, rich or poor, male or female, because it's not an expensive sport to play. There are no greens fees, as somebody pointed out in some of the things that I read yesterday. Most of the courses are maintained by tax dollars. So is that the case, that everybody's playing this? And when a national or an international competition is going on, is it strictly men against men, women against women, or is the field mixed?
There's different levels that you can play at between the genders. Each gender has a open field, which is the professionals. There's also intermediate and advanced and recreational as well. So if you're somebody who is just getting started playing disc golf, maybe have thrown only one or two rounds, you can still go out and play in a PDGA sanctioned tournament as a rec player, which is really just kind of a for fun sort of thing, which keeps your score. And you'll be able to get the full experience of playing in a tournament, having your round scored officially by the PDGA. So not only is it accessible to play casually, it's accessible to play on an organized level as well.
The real money in most sports comes from television. At least traditionally it has in the modern era come from TV because of the TV rights. Is that happening to disc golf?
Disc golf is getting on television, but mostly in the form of highlights, specifically hole-in-ones on ESPN Top 10. But we're not getting tournament coverage on cable TV, on network TV. Basically, the way that we're growing so fast is through YouTube. There are a lot of producers right now that are going out and filming events. Typically, the top card, the lead card, will have two different people filming it. And by two different people, I mean each crew has three people and they're filming it from different angles. And these YouTube videos are getting upwards between 50,000 and over 100,000 views per video. And so that's where we're getting most of our content out there in the world. It's just through YouTube.
Is that increasing the participation of other people and the interest in the sports by people?
Absolutely. It's I've been playing for 11 years, and when I first started, there was nothing on YouTube. There was basically a very, very basic instructional video, like, what is disc golf? And some guy just throwing a Frisbee around, and it wasn't really professional at all. And now there's hundreds of thousands of videos, I'm sure, on YouTube.
So has this changed the level of competition? In other words, 11 years ago when you first turned pro,
yep.
Was the competition less then than it is for you today?
There were great players back then that were probably just as good as the players are now, but there's way more.
More of them.
There's way more of them, and they're coming out of the woodworks from everywhere, especially Europe. It's the fastest growing sport in Finland. And when you go to the sports stores, disc golf is in the front window on display. There's disc golf in large box stores here, you know, like Dick's and some places in Walmart, but it's kind of in the back and you don't really see it. It's up front in European sports stores. And Finland only has a 5 million population. However, they have over 550 courses. And to put that in perspective, Charlotte and the greater Charlotte area, we have like 3 million. Is that correct? Something around that?
Like that.
And we have like 14 to 18 courses like in this general area, and we're known as a Mecca. So think about that population per course. They have so many courses over there. So
did you have a job after college? Seriously, did you have a job after college and this was a hobby that now you have taken you've taken it on as a full-time job as a professional player
So I've done a lot of odd jobs. I worked at Moe's Southwest Grill for a little while. Welcome to Moe's. I basically just done freelance stuff. I also do graphic design, which kind of supplemented my income when disc golf wasn't paying the bills.
So when did you know I can do this and make money at this? I don't need to be at Moe's anymore. How did you know that?
Pretty early on. I started playing disc golf in May 2006, and I won the 2008 Amateur World Championships in Kalamazoo, Michigan. When I won that after playing for essentially a year and a half, and also was in college for a semester where I couldn't play, I realized that my game was growing at a really fast rate, and I knew that it wouldn't be long before I could compete.
Well,
you
won that in 2008. In 2009, you turned pro, and you were named the Pro Rookie of the Year in 2009. You've won 12 Worlds and USDGC Distance Champion titles. We'll talk about what that means in a second, and the 2016 Utah Open Champion, plus the National Championship last year as well. What do you think makes you so good at this? Is it athleticism? Is it the fact you're a pretty big guy? Is it physical strength? Is it mental? Obviously, you talked about the mental aspect of this. Mm-hmm. But how big a role does physical strength and size play in your being so successful?
Man, disc golfers really show up in any shape and size. I mean, there is a prototypical size, which is kind of the tall, lanky, mm-hmm. long arms, which allow the player to generate a lot more torque into their throw so they can throw further. But yeah, generally athleticism is going to be what sets the great players apart from the not so great players. However, there are some guys out there that aren't in the greatest shape that just are really, they have a lot of finesse and they can compete because they can make a lot of putts and throw the disc where they want to throw it. And I guess what sets me apart, I mean, my physical attributes, I mean, I'm 6'6". I've got a 6'8" wingspan. We call that the ape index. If you're wider than you are tall, then you can generally throw things with more velocity. And that's true for pitching and for quarterbacks mm-hmm. and definitely true for throwing frisbees. So that's always been a physical factor that has set me apart.
And Andy, you play, but you've kept your day job at the Beckler.
That's true, yeah. I'm not quite on Jeremy's level, so I'm not going on tour anytime soon, but I still do love to play.
Yeah. How often do you play?
Probably on the weekends, you know, once or twice a week.
And is it like golf? Do you put together a foursome, or do you just go out and play by yourself? How does it work?
It's really however you want it to be. If you want to go out to a course and play by yourself, just be alone, walking out in the park and counting your shots, then you can do that. But you can also call up your friends, post on the Charlotte Disc Golf Facebook page, grab a couple of people to meet you up at the course and go for a round. So it's you can really get out of disc golf whatever you want to.
If you've never played before, where would you start? And can you start with a frisbee, or do you have to go and buy an actual?
Don't start with a beach frisbee.
Okay.
Not start with a frisbee.
That'll not give you the desired results. It's a lot harder to throw, and you also kind of look.
Well, first things first, you got to get your stuff. So you're going to want to go to a disc golf store. Fortunately, Charlotte has one. It's called Another Round. It's on Note. It's in Nota. And you can get your first discs there. They have used discs if you don't want to buy a brand new disc. So you can get discs at a cheaper cost. And so after you have your discs.
Do you need a tee time at these public courses, or you just show
not.
Up?
Absolutely you, not. You just show up. Yeah, you show up and you see what's out there. You know, like Andy was saying, you can go out there and play by yourself. If there's a group playing, I remember when I first started playing, I would just go ask people, hey man, can I join your group? And I just would start playing with people, and that's what I enjoy about the sport.
The national championship was in Rock Hill last year, and you're playing in the world championship next week?
This coming weekend in Augusta, Georgia.
Yeah. Well, good luck with that.
Thank you.
I hope you do well. I hope you win. Jeremy
Colling
is a professional disc golf player, a winner of the U.S. National Championship last year. Andy Goh is a player and the co-host of Final Round Radio. It's a podcast that you can download at your favorite podcast location. Thank you all for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us, Mike.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.